It was context-bound or episodic memory that was so grossly disturbed in Greg, as is the case with most amnesiacs. Other sorts of memory were intact. Thus Greg had no difficulty remembering or applying geometric truths that he had learned in school. He saw instantly, for example, that the hypotenuse of a triangle was shorter than the sum of the two sides. Thus his semantic memory, so-called, was fairly intact. Again, he not only retained his power to play the guitar, but actually enlarged his musical repertoire, learning new techniques and fingering with Connie. He also learned to type while at Williams Bridge, so his procedural memory was also unimpaired. Finally, there seemed to be some sort of slow habituation or familiarization, so that he became able, within 3 months, to find his way about the hospital, to go to the coffee shop, the cinema, the auditorium, the patio, his favorite places. This sort of learning was exceedingly slow, but once it had been achieved, it was tenaciously retained. It was clear that Greg's tumor had caused damage that was complex and curious. First, it had compressed or destroyed structures of the inner or medial side of both the temporal lobes, in particular the hippocampus and its adjacent cortex, areas crucial for the capacity to form new memories. With such damage, the ability to acquire information about new facts and events is devastated. There ceases to be any explicit or conscious remembrance of these. But while Greg was so often unable to recall events or encounters or facts to consciousness, he might nonetheless have an unconscious or implicit memory of them, a memory expressed in performance or behavior. Such implicit ability to remember allowed him to become slowly familiar with the physical layout and routines of the hospital and with some of the staff, and to make judgments on whether certain persons or situations were pleasant or unpleasant. While explicit learning requires the integrity of the medial temporal lobe systems, implicit learning may employ more primitive and diffuse paths, as do the simple processes of conditioning and habituation. Explicit learning, however, involves the construction of complex percepts, syntheses of representations from every part of the cerebral cortex, brought together into a contextual unity or scene. Such syntheses can be held in mind for only a minute or two, the limit of short-term memory, and after this will be lost unless they can be shunted into long-term memory. Thus, higher-order memorization is a multi-stage process, involving the transfer of perceptions, of perceptual syntheses, from short-term to long-term memory. It is just such a transfer that fails to occur in people with temporal lobe damage. Thus, Greg can repeat a complicated sentence with complete accuracy and understanding the moment he hears it, but within 3 minutes or sooner, if he is distracted for an instant, he will retain not a trace of it, or any idea of its sense, or any memory that it ever existed. Larry Squire, a neuropsychologist at the University of California, San Diego, who has been a central figure in elucidating this shunting function of the temporal lobe memory system, speaks of the brevity, the precariousness of short-term memory in us all. All of us, on occasion, suddenly lose a perception or an image or a thought we had vividly in mind. Damn it, we may say, I've forgotten what I wanted to say. But only in amnesiacs is this precariousness realized to the full. Yet while Greg, no longer capable of transforming his perceptions or immediate memories into permanent ones, remains stuck in the 60s, when his ability to learn new information broke down, he has nevertheless adapted somehow and absorbed some of his surroundings, albeit very slowly and incompletely. Some amnesiacs have brain damage largely confined to the memory systems of the diencephalon and medial temporal lobe. Others are not only amnesiac, but have frontal lobe syndromes too. Yet others, like Greg with immense tumors, tend to have a third area of damage as well, deep below the cerebral cortex, in the forebrain, or diencephalon. In Greg, this widespread damage had created a very complicated clinical picture, with sometimes overlapping or even contradictory symptoms and syndromes. Thus, though his amnesia was chiefly caused by damage to the temporal lobe systems, damage to the diencephalon and frontal lobes also played a part. Similarly, there were multiple origins for his blandness and indifference, for which damage to the frontal lobes, diencephalon, and pituitary gland was in varying degrees responsible. In fact, Greg's tumor first caused damage to his pituitary gland. This was responsible not only for his gain in weight and loss of body hair, but also for undermining his hormonally driven aggressiveness and assertiveness, and hence for his abnormal submissiveness and placidity. The diencephalon is especially a regulator of basic functions, of sleep, of appetite, of libido. And all of these were at a low ebb with Greg. He had, or expressed, no sexual interest. He did not think of eating or express any desire to eat unless food was brought to him. He seemed to exist only in the present, only in response to the immediacy of stimuli around him. If he was not stimulated, he fell into a sort of daze. Left alone, Greg would spend hours in the ward without spontaneous activity. This inert state was at first described by the nurses as brooding. It had been seen in the temple as meditating. My own feeling was that it was a profoundly pathological mental idling, almost devoid of mental content or affect. It was difficult to give a name to the state, so different from alert, attentive wakefulness, but also clearly quite different from sleep. It had a blankness resembling no normal state. It reminded me somewhat of the vacant states I had seen with some of my post-encephalitic patients, and, as with them, went with profound damage to the diencephalon. As soon as one talked to him, or if he was stimulated by sounds, especially music near him, he would come to, awaken in an astonishing way. Once Greg was awakened, once his cortex came to life, one saw that his animation itself had a strange quality, an uninhibited and quirky quality of the sort one tends to see when the orbital portions of the frontal lobes, that is, the portions adjacent to the eyes, are damaged, a so-called orbitofrontal syndrome. The frontal lobes are the most complex part of the brain, concerned not with the lower functions of movement and sensation, but the highest ones of integrating all judgment and behavior, all imagination and emotion, into that unique identity that we like to speak of as personality or self. Damage to other parts of the brain may produce specific disturbances of sensation or movement, of language, or of specific perceptual, cognitive, or memory functions. Damage to the frontal lobes, in contrast, does not affect these, but produces a subtler and profounder disturbance of identity. And it was this, rather than his blindness or his weakness or his disorientation or his amnesia, that so horrified his parents when they finally saw Greg in 1975. It was not just that he was damaged, but that he was changed beyond recognition, had been dispossessed, in his father's words, by a sort of simulacrum or changeling, which had Greg's voice and manner and humor and intelligence, but not his spirit or realness or depth. A changeling whose wisecracking and levity formed a shocking counterpoint to the fearful gravity of what had happened. This sort of wisecracking indeed is quite characteristic of such orbitofrontal syndromes, and is so striking that it has been given a name unto itself. Witzelsucht, or joking disease. Some restraint, some caution, some inhibition is destroyed, and patients with such syndromes tend to react immediately and incontinently to everything around them and everything within them. To virtually every object, every person, every sensation, every word, every thought, every emotion, every nuance and tone. There is an overwhelming tendency in such states to wordplay and puns. Once when I was in Greg's room, another patient walked past. "That's Bernie," I said.
"Bernie the Herney,"
quipped Greg. Another day when I visited him, he was in the dining room awaiting lunch. When a nurse announced, "Lunch is here," he immediately responded,
"It's time for cheer."
When she said, "Shall I take the skin off your chicken?" he instantly responded,
"Yeah. Why don't you slip me some skin?"
"Oh, you want the skin?" she asked, puzzled.
"Nah,"
he replied.
"It's just a saying."
He was, in a sense, preternaturally sensitive. But it was a sensitivity that was passive, without selectivity or focus. There is no differentiation in such a sensitivity. The grand, the trivial, the sublime, the ridiculous are all mixed up and treated as equal. There may be a childlike spontaneity and transparency about such patients in their immediate and unpremeditated and often playful reactions, and yet there is something ultimately disquieting and bizarre, because the reacting mind, which may still be highly intelligent and inventive, loses its coherence, its inwardness, its autonomy, its self, and becomes the slave of every passing sensation. The French neurologist François Lhermitte speaks of an environmental dependency syndrome in such patients, a lack of psychological distance between them and their environment. So it was with Greg. He seized his environment. He was seized by it. He could not distinguish himself from it. Dreaming and waking for us are usually distinct. Dreaming is enclosed in sleep and enjoys a special license because it is cut off from external perception and action, while waking perception is constrained by reality. But in Greg, the boundary between waking and sleep seemed to break down. And what emerged was a sort of waking, or public dream, in which dreamlike fancies and associations and symbols would proliferate and weave themselves into the waking perceptions of the mind. These associations were often startling and sometimes surrealistic in quality. They showed the power of fancy at play, and specifically the mechanisms, displacement, condensation, overdetermination, and so on, that Freud has shown to be characteristic of dreams. One felt all this very strongly with Greg, that he was often in some intermediate half-dreamlike state in which, if the normal control and selectivity of thinking was lost, there was a half-freedom, half-compulsion of fantasy and wit. To see this as pathological was necessary, but insufficient. It had elements of the primitive, the childlike, the playful. Greg's absurdist, often gnomic utterances, along with his seeming serenity, actually blandness, gave him an appearance of innocence and wisdom combined, gave him a special status on the ward, ambiguous but respected, a holy fool. Though as a neurologist I had to speak of Greg's syndrome, his deficits, I did not feel this was adequate to describe him. One felt, that he had become another kind of person, that though his frontal lobe damage had taken away his identity in a way, it had also given him a sort of identity or personality, albeit of an odd and perhaps a primitive sort. If Greg was alone in a corridor, he seemed scarcely alive. But as soon as he was in company, he was a different person altogether. He would come too. He would be funny, charming, ingenuous, sociable. Everyone liked him. He would respond to anyone at once with a lightness and a humor and an absence of guile or hesitation. And if there was something too light or flippant or indiscriminate in his interactions and reactions, and if, moreover, he lost all memory of them in a minute, well, there were worse things. It was understandable, one of the results of his disease. Thus one was very aware in a hospital for chronic patients like ours, a hospital where feelings of melancholy, of rage, and of hopelessness simmer and preside, of the virtue of a patient such as Greg, who never appeared to have bad moods, and who, when activated by others, was invariably cheerful, euphoric. He seemed, in an odd way, and in consequence of his sickness, to have a sort of vitality or health, a cheeriness, an inventiveness, a directness, an exuberance, which other patients, and indeed the rest of us, found delightful in small doses. And where he had been so difficult, so tormented, so rebellious in his pre-Krishna days, all this anger and torment and angst now seemed to have vanished. He seemed to be at peace. His father, who had had a terrible time in Greg's stormy days, before he got tamed by drugs, by religion, by tumor, said to me in an unbuttoned moment, "It's like he had a lobotomy." And then, with great irony, "Frontal lobes. Who needs them?" One of the most striking peculiarities of the human brain is the great development of the frontal lobes. They are much less developed in other primates and hardly evident at all in other mammals. They are the part of the brain that grows and develops most after birth. And their development is not complete until about the age of 7. But our ideas about the function of the frontal lobes and the role they play have had a tortuous and ambiguous history and are still far from clear. These uncertainties are well exemplified by the famous case of Phineas Gage and the interpretations and misinterpretations from 1848 to the present of his case. Gage was the very capable foreman of a gang of workers constructing a railroad line near Burlington, Vermont, when a bizarre accident befell him in September 1848. He was setting an explosive charge using a tamping iron, a crowbar-like instrument weighing 13 pounds and more than a yard long, when the charge went off prematurely, blowing the tamping iron straight through his head. Though he was knocked down, incredibly he was not killed, but only stunned for a moment. He was able to get up and take a cart into town. There he appeared perfectly rational and calm and alert and greeted the local doctor by saying, "Doctor, here is business enough for you." Soon after his injury, Gage developed a frontal lobe abscess and fever, but this resolved within a few weeks, and by the beginning of 1849 he was called completely recovered. That he had survived at all was seen as a medical miracle, and that he was seemingly unchanged after sustaining huge damage to the frontal lobes of the brain seemed to support the idea that these were either functionless or had no functions that could not be performed equally by the remaining undamaged portions of the brain. Where phrenologists earlier in the century had seen every part of the brain's surface as the seat of a particular intellectual or moral faculty, a reaction to this had set in during the 1830s and 1840s, to such an extent that the brain was sometimes seen as being as undifferentiated as the liver. Indeed, the great physiologist Florenz had said, "The brain secretes thought as the liver secretes bile." The apparent absence of any change in Gage's behavior seemed to support this notion. Such was the influence of this doctrine that, despite clear evidence from other sources of a radical change in Gage's character within weeks of the accident, it was only 20 years later that the physician who had studied him most closely, John Martin Harlow, now apparently moved by the new doctrines of higher and lower levels in the nervous system, the higher inhibiting or constraining the lower, provided a vivid description of all that he had ignored, or at least not mentioned, in 1848. Gage is fitful, irreverent, indulging at times in the grossest profanity, which was not previously his custom, manifesting but little deference for his fellows, impatient of restraint or advice when it conflicts with his desires, at times pertinaciously obstinate, yet capricious and vacillating, devising many plans of future operations, which are no sooner arranged than they are abandoned in turn for other appearing more feasible. A child in his intellectual capacity and manifestations, he has the animal passions of a strong man. Previous to his injury, although untrained in the schools, he possessed a well-balanced mind, and was looked upon by those who knew him as a shrewd, smart businessman, very energetic and persistent in executing all his plans of operation. In this regard, his mind was radically changed, so decidedly that his friends and acquaintances said he was no longer Gage. It seemed that a sort of disinhibition had occurred with the frontal lobe injury, releasing something animal-like or childlike, so that Gage now became a slave of his immediate whims and impulses, or what was immediately around him, without the deliberation, the consideration of past and future that had marked him in the past, or his previous concern for others and the consequences of his actions. But excitement, release, disinhibition are not the only possible effects of frontal lobe damage. David Ferrier, whose Galstonian lectures of 1879 introduced the Gage case to a worldwide medical community, observed a different sort of syndrome in 1876, when he removed the frontal lobes of monkeys. Notwithstanding this apparent absence of physiological symptoms, I could perceive a very decided alteration in the animal's character and behavior. Instead of, as before, being actively interested in their surroundings and curiously prying into all that came within the field of their observation, they remained apathetic or dull or dozed off to sleep, responding only to the sensations or impressions of the moment, or varying their listlessness with restless and purposeless wanderings to and fro. While not actually deprived of intelligence, they had lost, to all appearance, the faculty of attentive and intelligent observation. In the 1880s, it became apparent that tumors of the frontal lobes could produce symptoms of many sorts, sometimes listlessness, hebetude, slowness of mental activity, sometimes a definite change in character and loss of self-control, sometimes even, according to Gowers, chronic insanity. The first operation for a frontal lobe tumor was performed in 1884, and the first frontal lobe operation for purely psychiatric symptoms was done in 1888. The rationale here was that in these, probably schizophrenic patients, the obsessions, the hallucinations, the delusional excitements were due to overactivity or pathological activity in the frontal lobes. There was to be no repetition of such forays for 45 years until the 1930s, when the Portuguese neurologist Egas Moniz devised the operation he called prefrontal leucotomy, and immediately applied this to 20 patients, some with anxiety and depression, some with chronic schizophrenia. The results he claimed aroused huge interest when his monograph was published in 1936, and his lack of rigor, his recklessness, and perhaps dishonesty were all overlooked in the flush of therapeutic enthusiasm. Moniz's work led to an explosion of psychosurgery, the term he had coined all over the world. Brazil, Cuba, Romania, Great Britain, and especially Italy. But its greatest resonance was to be in the United States, where the neurologist Walter Freeman invented a horrible new form of surgical approach that he called transorbital lobotomy. He described the procedure as follows. This consists of knocking them out with a shock, and while they are under the anesthetic, thrusting an ice pick up between the eyeball and the eyelid through the roof of the orbit actually into the frontal lobe of the brain and making the lateral cut by swinging the thing from side to side. I have done 2 patients on both sides and another on one side without running into any complications, except a very black eye in one case. There may be trouble later on, but it seemed fairly easy, although definitely a disagreeable thing to watch. It remains to be seen how these cases hold up, but so far they have shown considerable relief of their symptoms, and only some of the minor behavior difficulties that follow lobotomy. They can even get up and go home within an hour or so. The ease of doing psychosurgery as an office procedure with an ice pick aroused not consternation and horror, as it should have, but emulation. More than 10,000 operations had been done in the United States by 1949, and a further 10,000 in the 2 years that followed. Monish was widely acclaimed as a savior and received the Nobel Prize in 1951, the climax, in MacDonald Critchley's words, of this chronicle of shame. What was achieved, of course, was never cure, but a docile state, a state of passivity, as far or farther from health than the original active symptoms, and unlike these, with no possibility of resolution or reversal. Robert Lowell, in Memories of West Street and Lepke, writes of the lobotomized Lepke: "Flabby, bald, lobotomized, he drifted in a sheepish calm, where no agonizing reappraisal jarred his concentration on the electric chair, hanging like an oasis in his air of lost connections. When I worked at a state psychiatric hospital between 1966 and 1990, I saw dozens of these pathetic, lobotomized patients, many far more damaged even than Lepke. Some psychically dead, murdered by their cure. Whether or not there are in the frontal lobes a mass of pathological circuits causing the torments of mental illness, the simplistic notion first put forward in the 1880s and embraced by Monish, there is certainly a downside to their great and positive powers. The weight of consciousness and conscience and conscientiousness itself, the weight of duty, obligation, responsibility, can press on us sometimes with unbearable force, so that we long for a release from its crushing inhibitions, from sanity and sobriety. We long for a holiday from our frontal lobes, a Dionysiac fiesta of sense and impulse. That this is a need of our constrained, civilized, hyperfrontal nature has been recognized in every time and culture. All of us need to take little holidays from our frontal lobes. The tragedy is when, through grave illness or injury, there is no return from the holiday, as with Phineas Gage or with Greg." In a March 1979 note about Greg, I reported that games, songs, verses, converse, etc., hold him together completely, because they have an organic rhythm and stream, a flowing of being, which carries and holds him. I was strongly reminded here of what I had seen with my amnesiac patient, Jimmy, how he seemed held together when he attended Mass, by his relationship to and participation in an act of meaning, an organic unity which overrode or bypassed the disconnections of his amnesia. And what I had observed with a patient in England, a musicologist with profound amnesia from a temporal lobe encephalitis, unable to remember events or facts for more than a few seconds, but able to remember, and indeed to learn, elaborate musical pieces, to conduct them, to perform them, and even to improvise at the organ. It was similar with Greg as well. He not only had an excellent memory for songs of the 60s, but was able to learn new songs easily, despite his difficulty in retaining any facts. It seemed as if wholly different kinds and mechanisms of memory might be involved. Greg was also able to pick up limericks and jingles with ease, and had indeed picked up hundreds of these from the radio and television that were always on in the ward. Soon after his admission, I tested him with the following limerick. Hush-a-bye, baby, hush quite a lot. Bad babies get rabies and have to be shot. Greg immediately repeated this without error, laughed at it, asked if I'd made it up, and compared it with something gruesome like Edgar Allan Poe. But 2 minutes later, he could not recall it, until I reminded him of the underlying rhythm. With a few more repetitions, he learned it without cueing, and thereafter recited it whenever he met me. Was this facility for learning jingles and songs a mere procedural or performative one? Or could it provide emotional depth or generalizability of a sort that Greg did not normally have access to? There seemed no doubt that some music could move him profoundly, could be a door to depths of feeling and meaning to which he normally had no access, and one felt Greg was a different person at these times. He no longer seemed to have a frontal lobe syndrome, but was, so to speak, temporarily cured by the music. Even his EEG, so slow and incoherent most of the time, became calm and rhythmical with music. It is easy to show that simple information can be embedded in songs. Thus we can give Greg the date every day in the form of a jingle, and he can readily isolate this and say it when asked without the jingle. But what does it mean to say, "This is July 9th, 1995, when one is sunk in the profoundest amnesia, when one has lost a sense of time and history, when one is existing from moment to moment in a sequenceless limbo"? Knowing the date means nothing in these circumstances. Could one, however, through the evocativeness and power of music, perhaps using songs with specially written lyrics, songs that relate something valuable about himself or the current world, accomplish something more lasting, deeper? Give Greg not only the facts, but a sense of time and history, of the relatedness of events, an entire, if artificial, framework for thinking and feeling. It seemed natural at this time, given Greg's blindness and the revelation of his potential for learning, that he should be given an opportunity to learn Braille. Arrangements were made with the Jewish Institute for the Blind for him to enter intensive training 4 times a week. It should not have been a disappointment, nor indeed a surprise, that Greg was unwilling to learn any Braille, that he was startled and bewildered at finding this imposed on him and cried out, "What's going on? Do you think I'm blind? Why am I here with blind people all around me?" Attempts were made to explain things to him, and he responded with impeccable logic. "If I were blind, I would be the first person to know it." The Institute said they had never had such a difficult patient, and the project was quietly allowed to drop. And indeed, with the failure of the Braille program, a sort of hopelessness gripped us, and perhaps Greg too. We could do nothing, we felt. He had no potential for change. Greg, by this time, had had several psychological and neuropsychological evaluations, and these, besides commenting on his memory and attentional problems, had all spoken of him as being shallow, infantile, insightless, euphoric. It was easy to see why these words had been used. Greg was like this for much of the time. But was there a deeper Greg beneath his illness, beneath the shallowing effect of his frontal lobe loss and amnesia? Early in 1979, when I questioned him, he said he was miserable, at least in the corporeal part, and added, "It's not much of a life." At such times, it was clear that he was not just frivolous and euphoric, but capable of deep and indeed melancholic reactions to his plight. The comatose Karen Ann Quinlan was then very much in the news, and each time her name and fate were mentioned, Greg became distressed and silent. He could never tell me explicitly why this so interested him, But it had to be, I felt, because of some sort of identification of her tragedy with his own. Or was this just his incontinent sympathy, his falling at once into the mood of any stimulus or news, falling almost helplessly, mimetically, into its mood? This was not a question I could decide at first, and perhaps, too, I was prejudiced against finding any depths in Greg, because the neuropsychological studies I knew of seemed to disallow this possibility. But these studies were based on brief evaluations, not on long-continued observation and relationship of a sort that is perhaps only possible in a hospital for chronic patients, or in situations where a whole world, a whole life, are shared with the patient. Greg's frontal lobe characteristics, his lightness, his quick-fire associations, were fun. But beyond this, they're shown through a basic decency and sensitivity and kindness. One felt that Greg, though damaged, still had a personality, an identity, a soul. When he came to Williamsbridge, we all responded to his intelligence, his high spirits, his wit. All sorts of therapeutic programs and enterprises were started at this time, but all of them, like the learning of Braille, ended in failure. The sense of Greg's incorrigibility gradually grew on us, and with this we started to do less, to hope less. Increasingly, he was left to his own devices. He slowly ceased to be a center of attention, the focus of eager therapeutic activities. More and more he was left to himself, left out of programs, not taken anywhere, quietly ignored. It is easy, even if one is not an amnesiac, to lose touch with current reality in the back wards of hospitals for the chronically ill. There is a simple round that has not changed in 20 or 50 years. One is wakened, fed, taken to the toilet, and left to sit in a hallway. One has lunch, one is taken to bingo, one has dinner and goes to bed. The television may indeed be left on, blaring, in the television room, but most patients pay no attention to it. Greg, it is true, enjoyed his favorite soap operas and westerns and learned an enormous number of advertising jingles by heart. But the news, for the most part, he found boring and increasingly unintelligible. Years can pass in a sort of timeless limbo with few and certainly no memorable markers of the passage of time. As 10 years or so went by, Greg showed a complete absence of development. His talk seemed increasingly dated and repertorial, for nothing new was being added to it or him. The tragedy of his amnesia seemed to become greater with the years, although his amnesia itself, his neurological syndrome, remained much the same. In 1988, Greg had a seizure. He had never had one before, although he had been on anticonvulsants as a precaution since the time of his surgery. And in the seizure broke a leg. He did not complain of this. He did not even mention it. It was only discovered when he tried to stand up the following day. He had apparently forgotten it as soon as the pain eased and as soon as he had found a comfortable position. His not knowing that he had broken a leg seemed to me to have similarities to his not knowing he was blind, his inability with his amnesia to hold in mind an absence. When the leg caused pain briefly, he knew something had happened. He knew it was there. As soon as the pain ceased, it went from his mind. Had he had visual hallucinations or phantoms, as the blind sometimes do, at least in the first months and years after losing their sight, he could have spoken of them, said, "Look," or "Wow." But in the absence of actual visual input, he could hold nothing in mind about seeing or not seeing or the loss of a visual world. In his person and in his world now, Greg knew only presence, not absence. He seemed incapable of registering any loss, loss of function in himself or of an object or a person. In June of 1990, Greg's father, who would come every morning before work to see Greg and would joke and chat with him for an hour, suddenly died. I was away at the time, mourning my own father, and hearing the news of Greg's bereavement on my return, I hastened to see him. He had been given the news, of course, when it happened, and yet I was not quite sure what to say. Had he been able to absorb this new fact? "I guess you must be missing your father," I ventured. "What do you mean?" Greg answered. "He comes every day. I see him every day." "No," I said, "he's no longer coming. He has not come for some time. He died last month." Greg flinched, turned ashen, became silent. I had the impression he was shocked, doubly shocked, at the sudden appalling news of his father's death, and at the fact that he himself did not know, had not registered, did not remember. "I guess he must have been around 50, he said. "No, Greg," I answered. "He was well up in his 70s. Greg grew pale again as I said this. I left the room briefly. I felt he needed to be alone with all this. But when I returned a few minutes later, Greg had no memory of the conversation we had had, of the news I had given him, no idea that his father had died. Very clearly, at least, Greg showed a capacity for love and grief. If I had ever doubted Greg's capacity for deeper feeling, I no longer doubted it now. He was clearly devastated by his father's death. He showed nothing flip, no levity at this time. But would he have the ability to mourn? Mourning requires that one hold the sense of loss in one's mind. And it was far from clear to me that Greg could do this. One might indeed tell him that his father had died again and again. And every time it would come as something shocking and new and cause immeasurable distress. But then, in a few minutes, he would forget and be cheerful again, and was so prevented from going through the work of grief, the mourning. I made a point of seeing Greg frequently in the following months, but I did not again bring up the subject of his father's death. It was not up to me, I thought, to confront him with this. Indeed, it would be pointless and cruel to do so. Life itself surely would do so, for Greg would discover his father's absence. I made the following note on November 26, 1990. Greg shows no conscious knowing that his father has died. When asked where his father is, he may say, "Oh, he went down to the patio," or "he couldn't make it today," or something else plausible. But he no longer wants to go home on weekends, on Thanksgiving, as he so loved to. He must find something sad or repugnant in the fatherless house now. Even though he cannot consciously remember or articulate this, clearly he has established an association of sadness. Toward the end of the year, Greg, normally a sound sleeper, started to sleep poorly, to get up in the middle of the night and wander gropingly for hours around his room. "I've lost something. I'm looking for something," he would say when asked. But what he had lost, what he was looking for, he could never explain. One could not avoid the feeling that Greg was looking for his father, even though he could give no account of what he was doing and had no explicit knowledge of what he had lost. But it seemed to me there was perhaps now an implicit knowledge and perhaps, too, a symbolic, though not a conceptual, knowing. Greg had seemed so sad since his father's death that I felt he deserved a special celebration. And when I heard in August of 1991 that his beloved group, the Grateful Dead, would be playing at Madison Square Garden in a few weeks, this seemed just the thing. Indeed, I had met one of the drummers in the band, Mickey Hart, earlier in the summer, when we had both testified before the Senate about the therapeutic powers of music. And he made it possible for us to obtain tickets at the last minute, to bring Greg, wheelchair and all, into the concert, where a special place would be saved for him near the soundboard, where acoustics were best. We made these arrangements at the last minute, and I had given Greg no warning, not wanting to disappoint him if we failed to get seats. But when I picked him up at the hospital and told him where we were going, he showed great excitement. We got him dressed swiftly and bundled him into the car. As we got into Midtown, I opened the car windows, and the sounds and smells of New York came in. As we cruised down 33rd Street, the smell of hot pretzels suddenly struck him. He inhaled deeply and laughed. "That's the most New York smell in the world." There was an enormous crowd converging on Madison Square Garden, most in tie-dyed T-shirts. I had hardly seen a tie-dyed T-shirt in 20 years, and I myself began to think we were back in the 60s, or perhaps that we had never left them. I was sorry that Greg could not see this crowd. He would have felt himself one of them, at home. Stimulated by the atmosphere, Greg started to talk spontaneously, very unusual for him, and to reminisce about the 60s. "Yeah, there were the bee-ins in Central Park. They haven't had one for a long time, over a year maybe, can't remember exactly. Concerts, music, acid, grass, everything. First time I was there was Flower Power Day. Good times. Lots of things started in the 60s. Acid rock, the bee-ins, the lovin', smokin'. Don't see it much these days. Allen Ginsberg? He's down in the Village a lot, or in Central Park. I haven't seen him for a long time. It's over a year since I last saw him." Greg's use of the present tense, or the near-present tense, his sense of all these events not as far distant, much less as terminated, but as having taken place a year ago maybe, and by implication, likely to take place again at any time, all this, which seems so pathological, so anachronistic in clinical testing, seemed almost normal, natural, now that we were part of the 60s crowd sweeping toward the garden. Inside the garden, we found the special place reserved for Greg's wheelchair near the soundboard. And now Greg was growing more excited by the minute. The roar of the crowd excited him. "It's like a giant animal," he said. And the sweet, hash-laden air. "What a great smell," he said, inhaling deeply. "It's the least stupid smell in the world." As the band came on stage and the noise of the crowd grew greater, Greg was transported by the excitement and started clapping loudly and shouting in an enormous voice, "Bravo! Bravo!" Then, "Let's go!" followed by, "Let's go, Hypo!" followed homophonously by, "Row, row, row, Harry Bow." Pausing a moment, Greg said to me, "See the tombstone behind the drums? See Jerry Garcia's afro?" With such conviction that I was momentarily taken in and looked in vain for a tombstone behind the drums, before realizing it was one of Greg's confabulations. And at the now gray hair of Jerry Garcia, which fell in a straight, unhindered descent to his shoulders. And then, "Pigpen!" Greg exclaimed. "You see Pigpen there?" "No," I replied hesitantly, not knowing how to reply. "He's not there. You see, he's not with the dead anymore." "Not with them?" said Greg in astonishment. "What happened? He got busted or something?" "No, Greg, not busted. He died." "That's awful," Greg answered, shaking his head, shocked. And then a minute later, he nudged me again. "Pigpen! You see Pigpen there?" And word for word, the whole conversation repeated itself. But then, the thumping, pounding excitement of the crowd got him. The rhythmic clapping and stamping and chanting possessed him, and he started to chant, "The dead, the dead." Then, with a shift of rhythm and a slow emphasis on each word, "We want the dead." And then, "Tobacco Road, Tobacco Road," the name of one of his favorite songs, until the music began. The band began with an old song, "Ico, Ico." And Greg joined in with gusto, with abandon, clearly knowing all the words and especially luxuriating in the African-sounding chorus. The whole vast garden now was in motion with the music. 18,000 people responding together, everyone transported, every nervous system synchronized in unison. The first half of the concert had many earlier pieces, songs from the 60s, and Greg knew them, loved them, joined in. His energy and joy were amazing to see. He clapped and sang nonstop, with none of the weakness and fatigue he generally showed. He showed a rare and wonderful continuity of attention, everything orienting him, holding him together. Looking at Greg transformed in this way, I could see no trace of his amnesia, his frontal lobe syndrome. He seemed, at this moment, completely normal, as if the music was infusing him with its own strength, its coherence, its spirit. I had wondered whether we should leave at the break midway through the concert. He was, after all, a disabled, wheelchair-bound patient who had not really been out on the town at a rock concert for more than 20 years. But he said, no, I want to stay. I want it all. An assertion, an autonomy I rejoiced to see and had hardly ever seen in his compliant life at the hospital. So we stayed, and in the interval went backstage where Greg had a large hot pretzel and then met Mickey Hart and exchanged a few words with him. He had looked a little tired and pale before, but now he was flushed, excited by the encounter, charged and eager to be back for more music. But the second half of the concert was something strange for Greg. More of the songs dated from the mid or late 70s and had lyrics that were unknown to him, though they were familiar in style. He enjoyed these, clapping and singing along wordlessly, or making up words as he went. But then there were newer songs, radically different, like Picasso Moon, with dark and deep harmonies, and an electronic instrumentation such as would have been impossible, unimaginable in the 1960s. Greg was intrigued but deeply puzzled. "It's weird stuff," he said. "I never heard anything like it before." He listened intently, all his musical senses stirred, but with a slightly scared and bewildered look, as if seeing a new animal, a new plant, a new world for the first time. "I guess it's some new experimental stuff," he said. "Something they never played before. Sounds futuristic. Maybe it's the music of the future." The newer songs he heard went far beyond any development that he could have imagined, were so beyond and in some ways so unlike what he associated with the dead that it blew his mind. It was, he could not doubt, their music he was hearing, but it gave him an almost unbearable sense of hearing the future. As late Beethoven would have struck a devotee if it had been played at a concert in 1800. "That was fantastic," he said as we filed out of the garden. "I will always remember it. I had the time of my life." I played CDs of the Grateful Dead in the car on the way home, to hold as long as possible the mood and memory of the concert. I feared that if I stopped playing the Dead or talking about them for a single moment, all memory of the concert would go from his mind. Greg sang along enthusiastically all the way back, and when we parted at the hospital, he was still in an exuberant concert mood. But the next morning when I came to the hospital early, I found Greg in the dining room alone, facing the wall. I asked him about the Grateful Dead. What did he think of them? "Great group," he said. "I love them. I heard them in Central Park and at the Fillmore East." "Yes," I said, "you told me. But have you seen them since? Didn't you just hear them at Madison Square Garden?" "No," he said. "I've never been to the garden." Greg has no recollection of the concert, seemingly. But when I was sent a tape of it, he immediately recognized some of the new pieces, found them familiar, was able to sing them. "Where did you hear that?" I asked as we listened to Picasso Moon. He shrugged uncertainly, but there is no doubt that he has learned it nonetheless. I have taken now to visiting him regularly, with tapes of our concert and of the latest Grateful Dead concerts. He seems to enjoy the visits and has learned many of the new songs. And now, whenever I arrive and he hears my voice, he he lights up and greets me as a fellow deadhead. A surgeon's life. Tourette syndrome is seen in every race, every culture, every stratum of society. It can be recognized at a glance once one is attuned to it, and cases of barking and twitching, of grimacing, of strange gesturing, of involuntary cursing and blaspheming were recorded by Aretaeus of Cappadocia almost 2,000 years ago. Yet it was not clinically delineated until 1885, when Georges-Gilles de la Tourette, a young French neurologist, a pupil of Charcot's and a friend of Freud's, put together these historical accounts with observations of some of his own patients. The syndrome, as he described it, was characterized above all by convulsive tics, by involuntary mimicry or repetition of others' words or actions, echolalia and echopraxia, and by the involuntary or compulsive utterances of curses and obscenities, coprolalia. Some individuals, despite their affliction, showed an odd insouciance or nonchalance, some a tendency to make strange, often witty, occasionally dreamlike associations, some extreme impulsiveness and provocativeness, a constant testing of physical and social boundaries, some a constant restless reacting to the environment, a lunging at and sniffing of everything, or a sudden flinging of objects, and yet others an extreme stereotypy and obsessiveness. No two patients were ever quite the same. Any disease introduces a doubleness into life. And it, with its own needs, demands limitations. With Tourette's, the it takes the form of explicit compulsion, a multitude of explicit impulsions and compulsions. One is driven to do this, to do that, against one's own will, or in deference to the alien will of the it. There may be a conflict, a compromise, a collusion between these wills. Thus, being possessed can be more than a figure of speech for someone with an impulse disorder like Tourette's, and no doubt in the Middle Ages, it was sometimes literally seen as possession. Tourette himself was fascinated by the phenomenon of possession and wrote a play about the epidemic of demonic possession in medieval Loudun. But the relation of disease and self, it and I, can be particularly complex in Tourette's, especially if it has been present from early childhood, growing up with the self, intertwining itself in every possible way. The Tourette's and the self shape themselves each to the other, come more and more to complement each other, until finally, like a long married couple, they become a single compound being. This relation is often destructive, but it can also be constructive, can add speed and spontaneity and a capacity for unusual and sometimes startling performance. For all its intrusiveness, Tourette's may be used creatively too. Yet in the years after its delineation, Tourette's tended to be seen not as an organic, but as a moral disease, an expression of mischievousness or weakness of the will, to be treated by rectifying the will. From the 1920s to the 1960s, it tended to be seen as a psychiatric disease, to be treated by psychoanalysis or psychotherapy, but this, on the whole, proved ineffective too. Then, with the demonstration in the early 1960s that the drug haloperidol could dramatically suppress its symptoms, Tourette's was regarded, in a sudden reversal, as a chemical disease, the result of an imbalance of a neurotransmitter, dopamine in the brain. But all these views are partial and reductive and fail to do justice to the full complexity of Tourette's. Neither a biological, nor a psychological, nor a moral social viewpoint is adequate. We must see Tourette's not only simultaneously from all three perspectives, but from an inner perspective, an existential perspective, that of the affected person himself. Inner and outer narratives here, as everywhere, must fuse. Many professions, one would think, would be closed to someone with elaborate tics and compulsions or strange antic behaviors, but this does not seem to be the case. Tourette's affects perhaps one person in a thousand, and we find people with Tourette's, sometimes the most severe Tourette's, in virtually every walk of life. There are Tourette-ic writers, mathematicians, musicians, actors, disc jockeys, construction workers, social workers, mechanics, athletes. Some things, one might think, would be completely out of the question. Above all, perhaps, the intricate, precise, and steady work of a surgeon. This would have been my own belief not so long ago. But now, improbably, I know 5 surgeons with Tourette's. I first met Dr. Carl Bennett at a scientific conference on Tourette's in Boston. His appearance was unexceptionable. He was 50-ish, of middle size, with a brownish beard and mustache, containing a hint of gray, and was dressed soberly in a dark suit. Until he suddenly lunged or reached for the ground, or jumped or jerked. I was struck both by his bizarre tics and by his dignity and calm. When I expressed incredulity about his choice of profession, he invited me to visit and stay with him, where he lived and practiced in the town of Brantford in British Columbia, to do rounds at the hospital with him, to scrub with him, to see him in action. Now, 4 months later, in early October, I found myself in a small plane approaching Brantford, full of curiosity and mixed expectations. Dr. Bennett met me at the airport, greeted me, a strange greeting, half lunge, half tick. A gesture of welcome, idiosyncratically Tourettized. Grabbed my case and led the way to his car in an odd, rapid, skipping walk, with a skip each fifth step, and sudden reachings to the ground as if to pick something up. The situation of Brantford is almost idyllic, nestled as it is in the shadow of the Rockies in southeast British Columbia, with Banff and its mountains to the north, and Montana and Idaho to the south. It lies in a region of great gentleness and fertility, but is ringed with mountains, glaciers, lakes. Bennett himself has a passion for geography and geology. A few years ago, he took a year off from his surgical practice to study both at the University of Victoria. As he drove, he pointed out moraines, stratifications, and other formations, so that what had at first seemed to my eyes a mere pastoral landscape became charged with a sense of history and faunic forces, of immense geological vistas. Such keen, fierce attention to every detail, such constant looking below the surface, such examination and analysis, are characteristic of the restless, questioning, Tourette-ic mind. It is, so to speak, the other side of its obsessive and perseverative tendencies, its disposition to reiterate, to touch, again and again. And indeed, whenever the stream of attention and interest was interrupted, Bennett's tics and iterations immediately reasserted themselves, in particular obsessive touchings of his mustache and glasses. His mustache had constantly to be smoothed and checked for symmetry. His glasses had to be balanced up and down, side to side, diagonally, in and out, with sudden ticky touchings of the fingers, until these too were exactly centered.